Urayoan Noel is originally from San Juan, Puerto Rico. He earned his BA from the University of Puerto Rico and an MA from Stanford and holds a PhD from New York University. He's the author of numerous poetry collections, including High Density Politics, Borinquen, and Cool Logic, which came out in 2005. His honors and awards include a fellowship from the Ford Foundation, an award from the Bronx Council on the Arts. And in 2013, he was named a Canto Mundo Fellow. And all of his writing and creative work has appeared in numerous journals such as Latino Studies, Contemporary Literature, BOM, and Fence. He's currently a professor at NYU. Urayoan Noel, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Are you in the Bronx or are you in Puerto Rico?
I am in my office at NYU, so somewhere more boringly institutional, but there you go.
Are you kidding?
Lower Manhattan.
NYU must be great teaching there. What, you teach in the English department, the Spanish department?
Spanish and English, right?
Appropriate, given my poetry, I'm joint appointed in English and Spanish and Portuguese.
Sweet.
Wow.
And do you teach at all in the Spanish MFA there?
Not at this point. I'm guessing I may at some point in the future. But there are certainly, as you may know, creative writing turf wars.
So yeah,
the Anglos, and the Hispanophones over there. So I'd rather not get into that and do my own far out things. So.
Yeah. at Fresno State, there were turf wars over the name Chicano. The English department couldn't offer Chicano lit classes because Chicano Studies got mad at them. They did.
Sure.
Well, congratulations on this book, Buzzing Hemisphere.
Oh, thank you. Hemisphere.
It's fantastic. It's so. Such an experience reading this. But before we get to the book, I wanted to start off with just kind of a basic question. On your webpage, you call yourself the stateless poet. Can you explain what you mean by that and how it affects your poetry?
Sure. Well, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, right? Partly because it's built around a series of puns, if you read that part of the website. So I'm playing with stateless, but also statement, right? So thinking about the ways in which my poetry doesn't necessarily look at the declarative or the narrative, right? That we sometimes look for, right, in socially engaged poetry. So I'm not necessarily telling you a story, trying to think about experiences in a more maybe stereophonic, right, or performative way. So there's that. But then, of course, there's also just the whole sense of Puerto Rico, right, as a stateless place. And also I'm honoring, I think, a tradition, which I link to on the website, of kind of innovative, experimental, performance-oriented New Yorican art and activism, particularly the late Pedro Pietri and the artist Alan Maldonado's web installation, ElPuertoRicanEmbassy, .org. So creating a kind of conceptual space, right, where a new kind of Puerto Rico is possible, or a new kind of New York, for that matter. So.
Right. One of the blurbs on the back of your book is by one of my own favorite poets, Victor Hernandez Cruz. He calls the book a stereo ping pong game between two languages, neither Spanglish nor translations. And I think that describes your work perfectly. You know, the poems are experimental, kind of like these music mashups, but with language. It even reminds me a little bit of sort of the broadcast that we get on TV, you know, where you're getting these simultaneous sound bites and strips of information and multiple narratives. And I'm wondering for you, you know, what's the goal when writing these types of experimental poems?
That's a great question. I mean, first, a shout out to the great Victor Maestro, right, for the blurb, very generous of him. But I guess there's a conceptual or a fancy theoretical answer, and then a more mundane answer, and I'm sure you relate to the mundane one. Basically, my mom was having all kinds of issues with her smartphone voice recognition because of her accent, right? And I thought, well, this is like years ago, right? You know, the software is supposed to make it easier for us to engage with the world. It doesn't, right? In the case of certain people with certain accents or certain backgrounds. So I started politicizing with the technology a little bit. The more I learned about it, the more I realized that there's all kinds of political decisions folks make when engineers make, right, when programming this. So, for example, a lot of the stuff you probably all have on your phone, right, is the simplest software is built to privilege, to prioritize business words, right? So when I do these homophonic self-translations, oftentimes the closest word will be, you know, email or, you know, text, right, or memo, right? So it becomes this way to parody, you know, corporate talk, right, and neoliberalism and all that, right? So it feels like I feel my own ambivalence towards these gadgets, right, these smartphones. They make all these kinds of connectivity possible, but they also come at the expense, right, of a kind of political trade-off and of surrendering our language to the powers that be. So
right.
That's interesting because I was thinking about when I was finding my way around Los Angeles, you know, I would have the GPS and it wouldn't say Sepulveda, it would say Sepulveda. And and when I call a friend, like, for example, Benjamin Sainz, I can't say Benjamin Sainz. I have to say Benjamin Sainz.
Oh, wow, yeah, right.
And it's almost like a colonization in a sense.
Absolutely. I got to say, on that note, the most inspiring thing I saw was I was in Brazil, in Rio, for about 5 years ago. And when I realized the GPSs in the cab there were in Brazilian Portuguese, I thought that was so amazing. That was some global south. You know, taking it over, right? We will make the technology honor our accent, you know,
so right,
especially
right.
In a primarily black city. It was so inspirational. So.
And I do get the sense that in your book, you know, that a lot of sort of the technology, that you're kind of subverting technology, or the engineering that's behind all of that, you know. And I think of your poem, United States, Estados Unidos, where you use an anagram app to create the poem. And then one of the statements I believe that I read, maybe on your website, it says that you use these sort of smartphone programs and apps as a way to, quote, investigate the promise and pitfalls of digital vernacular. I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I think, like I said, the part of it is culturally specific, right?
Right.
Thinking in a Boricua context, what happens to accents and what happens to the things that mark our speech, right, as rooted in a particular place or a particular community.
Right.
So there's a weird way in which technology is meant to deterritorialize, right? It finds the lowest common denominator, right? It translates for a kind of invisible general user. It's like that Univision Spanish, right, which is no person Spanish, right?
Right, no person,
it's this,
yes.
It's very carefully calibrated, right, commercial lingua franca, right, that does a particular kind of political work. And I think partly thinking of the vernacular, I mean, that some of that is just my own trajectory as a poet, even though I have this, you know, academic training and kind of very literary references. Starting out at the New Region Poets Cafe, reading my work, I'm thinking, wow, you know, especially seeing folks like Edwin Torres, right, some of the more kind of avant-garde sound-based work, and thinking, wow, you don't have to necessarily mean, right, you can just share, right, at the level of sensory experience, at the level of the body, right, and that becomes its own kind of politics. So re-embodying this kind of damaged or spectral, right, or hollowed out text speak, right, largely by rooting it in a particular place and a particular shared experience, right?
So. A couple of years ago, I saw you in Boston, and you were doing a poetry reading. One of the things that you did in between your poems, which I thought was brilliant and funny, you read into your phone, I don't remember what kind of phone, I guess it doesn't matter, it was a smartphone, you read into your phone, I think in English or Spanish, and but had the phone set on the other language, and it really was funny. In fact, I have my phone right now, and I'm going to say, estoy hablando con el poeta, all blah, and it comes out blondo.
Blondo.
All of us want to be blondo, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Who doesn't want to be blondo?
but that's such a brilliant experiment, and your poetry is like that too. It's like, you know, it takes languages and it just does so many different things with so many different words and sounds, and you must have a fun time writing your first drafts.
I mean, it's interesting because in a way, the story is more perverse than it seems. So this book in particular, I was on the tenure track and trying to get my scholarly book on the New Rican poets published. So for a long time, it was a struggle to try to juggle and find some room for my creative work. So to be candid, I just didn't have time to edit stuff. Like, so in a way, using these tools generatively, I can't actually send a poem to a journal. They ask me for work, but maybe I can, you know, maybe the app can help me out, right? So I think that's maybe one of the differences between my work and other folks who approach this, right, with more of a kind of avant-garde, right, pretension. Is my sense is also, in doing this, I know I'm also being complicit, right, with a kind of neoliberal apparatus, right? But I see that as a kind of inevitability, and I'm fascinated by it, especially in the context of, say, Latino communities, right, where historically there's been this digital divide, right, and we think of the questions of access are always really, really complicated, yet folks are using this, right? I'm teaching a class now on Latinos and social media. I'm thinking, you know, of the overrepresentation of Latinos on Instagram, for example, right?
So
I'm just fascinated by that, you know, on the one hand, how unresponsive to Latinos the mainstream media continues to be, but then the very creative ways in which communities are using, right, some of these technologies. And I'm thinking of my mom and her rocking her accent. I wanted to honor that, right, in the work. But yeah, what you mentioned, I think that was also when you saw me read, I want to say that was Tato Laviera's work, right? It was he recently passed on, one of the kind of iconic New Rican poets. I think Tato's work was very much about a kind of back and forth between English and Spanish and a kind of Afro-Puerto Rican untranslatability. And he insisted on that when I interviewed him for the book. So I thought, wow, how powerful. Let's show that our poetry resists, right, technology,
right.
That no matter how many apps you apply to his work, right, Tato's work remains kind of wonderfully untranslatable. So that's an inspiration.
Yeah, Tato, I had the opportunity to meet him one time years ago, and just what a generous soul, you know, that comes across through him and his work, you know, so may he rest in power. We're speaking with a poet, performance artist, and tech experimental artist, and NYU professor, Urayoan Noel, about his latest publication, Buzzing Hemisphere, which is out by the University of Arizona Press. I'm curious to know, Urayoan, what the submission process is like then for a body of work like this, you know? Yeah, I have to ask. Is it hard to find a publisher for it, or how does that go?
I want to thank first everybody at Arizona for thinking this was a book as opposed to some, you know, some weird quirky hobby, right? But it went through various drafts and it almost got in, you know, to various presses at various times. Mm-hmm. But I just kept doubling down, saying so each version I sent of it was more far out, right? I just got more. I was much more cynical about ever getting accepted anywhere. I'm just going to keep doubling down and doubling down and doubling down. And so
nice.
It became this beautifully kind of monstrous thing, right? So I'm going to fail on my own terms, right?
Yeah.
Spectacularly. And fortunately, right, I think folks at Arizona were into it, and they have this, you know, this great list, right, of kind of experimental leaning Latino poets, right? Edwin Torres' last book, Roberto Tejada, right? Carmen Jimenez Smith. So really, really wonderful folks. So I'm really happy to be sharing that space with them. But I think part of this was also happening since I wasn't thinking, right, about publication in the short term. It happened online, right? So I actually finally got a blog, a video blog together called Wokitokiteki, wokitokiteki.com. So that's Wokitokiteki. And I'm playing a lot with the walkie-talkie and the tech, so smartphones as kind of high-tech walkie-talkies, but also the process of walking. As you may see, a number of the poems were improvised while walking around various places in Puerto Rico and New York. Also on the blog now, there's poems in like the Puerto Rican neighborhood in Philly and in Chicago, right? So it's become this way for me to just map all these spaces and think about, you know, diaspora and think about, you know, where communities are. And so I guess I also direct folks who are interested, not just to the book, but also to think about the various performances and web installations, right?
Right.
That extend the project somewhat.
You know what I find really interesting about this book is the various ways that I imagine readers, or maybe we won't even call them readers, those who interact with it, how they how they might enter into the book. And I imagine there's countless ways. Tim said something before we started recording, which I thought was pretty brilliant. And rather than pretend like I said it, I'm going to quote him.
He says, in front of me, he's going to quote me. Okay, that's good.
He says that he enters the book like one would enter reading the Bible. You just open it up and pick a passage and you read and, you know, and you experience it. And I think that's a wonderful way of doing it. But I wanted to talk specifically about entering it for the bilingual reader, because you could enter it as a monolingual reader and favor the English or the Spanish, and then maybe kind of glide slightly over to the other one just to see, you know, how words would be and phrases would be expressed in another language. Or you could read it completely as a bilingual person, you know, one stanza and then seeing it again in English and then Spanish and then English. And I'm wondering if that other reader, that bilingual reader who's just as good in English as in Spanish, are you consciously making their experience different from the monolingual reader? And are you playing with language that only they'll get?
That's a great question. I mean, the short answer is yes. But I think there's also a kind of rationale behind it. I think I describe the translations as non-equivalent translations,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's kind of by design. First, I'm not sure there's such a thing, as we know, as a kind of equivalent translation, because language is culturally specific and it's historical, right? So there's that. But then also I'm thinking of the ways in which translation across the Americas, right, has been used in all kinds of ideological fashions. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's all kinds of folks now, I think Harris Fein saw it at Northwestern, right, and other folks working on like, say, what the ways in which the CIA, right, was translating Latin American and Latino poets, right,
mm-hmm.
folks like Julio de Burgos, right? So
mm-hmm.
in a very real way, right, the history, you know, we tend to think, oh, the Americas, and let's bring, you know, the hemispheres together. But in reality, a lot of the import behind that was was ideological, right? And so the fact that some of our great, you know, 20th century poets were mistranslating each other. I've been writing about Borges's Leaves of Grass, Hojas de Hierba, right? And so one thing that Borges does there is translate Whitman's Manhattan, his indigenous Manhattan, simply as Manhattan, right? So in doing so, you think, wow, look at the violence, right, of erasing, right, that indigenous presence and, you know, the ways in which Manhattan is this conceptual space, right? So so I guess my point is, I mean, two masters, right, Borges and Whitman, love them both, right? But the fact that you can read Borges' translation of Whitman as an homage, because Borges is a great reader of Anglophone literature, but also as a kind of act of political, you know, revision, maybe even sabotage, I know, betrayal, right? So I feel that way. I feel like as someone who's, you know, has a gringo father and a Puerto Rican mother and who was raised in a bilingual household, I feel a certain privilege, right, of a particular kind of bilingual experience, but also a sense that there's complicity on both sides, right? And I wanted to kind of honor that by maybe confronting the reader with her or his own complicity, right, by reminding the reader, right, that this is a kind of political project, right? The very idea of legibility is always, of course, political. But so that shows up in the book. So you have sometimes, right, I'm playing with hemispheres and I'm playing, you know, north and south also. So sometimes the English is on top and the Spanish is on the bottom, right? Right, yeah. And sometimes I want to make it seem like one is the original and one is the translation, but oftentimes I want to blur that, right? And I'm not sure what experience a particular bilingual reader might have in trying to decipher that. My sense is that if you're, you know, you can probably figure out some of what I'm doing, but hopefully I've made it tricky, right, for the reader as a way to kind of decenter any kind of bilingual privilege, right? There is no such thing as bilingual. I think we're all translingual. Also, a lesson I learned from people like Tato, right, is that the part of what you do at the intersections of language is complicate what both languages can be, right? So it's a book that's opposed to standard English and standard Spanish, right, and opposed to kind of the non-monolingual. I mean, I like Doris Sommer, the professor at Harvard, has this phrase in an essay about Tato called Irritating the State. And I think, how great is that, right?
Wow, so irritating,
you know, the non-monolingual fantasy, right, of the U.S. and think about how that's playing out politically right now as we speak. Right. But then also irritating, you know, banal, you know, linguistic nationalism in Latin America, where we know how, you know, the whole Bolivarian fantasy, right, that we can all be one Hispanophone familia, right? So what happens to the indigenous, what happens to the African and the Americas, right? So both are equally problematic to me, right? The kind of the monolingual in a Latin American context and the monolingual in a U.S. context. So I see this book as kind of showing the ideological implications, right, of that kind of monolingual fantasy.
I'm thinking about this, you know, an English reader of Neruda or Borges or, you know, a poet, all they have to do is dabble for a year or two in Spanish, and they think that all the translations they read aren't good enough. I mean, it's almost an immediate claim, like, oh, I wouldn't have do it that way. That's not what it means, you know, without really, you know, having mastered the language as much as the translator. And I'm sure there are bad translations. But my point is that I think people judge translations even if they don't know the other language as well as, you know, the translator. And so it's almost as if they step outside of the poem and they judge it and they kind of, you know, put their own perception over, you know, over the translation. I'm thinking that when people are doing that with your book, if they are tempted to do that, after a while they may begin to get a sense that you're kind of messing with them and you're messing with that part of them. And if they go with it, it could just really be kind of a rich wink wink experience with the writer.
Wink wink experience.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess that's, you know, we're playing with also the cultural capital, right, of languages. But I'm thinking also how that plays out, even in something like the title, right? Definitely, you know, Rumor Hemisférico, Buzzing Hemisphere, those aren't equivalent, right? But they also can't be, right? Because there are so many loaded puns in both. Right? So buzz means about 17 different things in the title, including neural buzz, right? Kind of the buzz of language, right? The buzz of, like, just, you know, cheap technology, right? And the noise, kind of the noise of digital culture. Yeah. But then also kind of from the neurological perspective and, you know, kind of BuzzFeed, right? That. And so rumor has other, you know, some that's of those, right, but it has other connotations, right? So rumor can be chisme, right? Can be gossip, right? So that sense that there's noise, but maybe non-equivalent kinds of noise that animate even the, you know, the title. So I think it's also, you know, working through of my own relationship to literary and poetic traditions in both languages. Right. And in that sense, it was important to me to get a blurb from someone like Victor, who's, you know, who's been a pionero, right, in terms of before there were anybody, right? There was Snaps in 1968, right, doing that kind of very, you know, very street corner, but amazingly savvy and amazingly sophisticated back and forth, right, and creating its own linguistic universe. So I think it was, I mean, there's a poem that references Aulista, right? There's a poem about Haroldo de Campos, right, the Brazilian concrete poet and his concept of transcreation, right? So in a very coded way, it's very much of a kind of geeks. I mean, I guess I love that about old, like the old 60s and 70s albums, right? That they were full of little, if you put your headphones and you were, you know, in the right chemical state, maybe, you could catch all the little inside jokes, right? And there's, I think there's that other level of listening for the, you know, the geeked out reader, right? That you can actually try to trace the steps. And actually in that way, even though it's a very maybe intimidating book on initial perusal, I think there's a coded references, right, that lead you back to a whole series of influences and traditions. So. Right.
Yeah, Snaps was very, just an incredible book. And I think, if I'm correct, Victor Hernandez Cruz probably wrote that when he was about 17, 18 years old.
Yes.
That's incredible. You know, I'm going to get off the page for a minute here and just talk about, you know, because I've seen you read your work before. I know Daniel just mentioned about seeing you present at a panel. And, you know, for those who've never had the opportunity to see you actually do your thing in the flesh, you know, your readings are never these sort of straightforward type readings, but more performative, and they often involve music or technology, like Daniel just talked about. And then, in fact, I did a reading, at Arizona State years ago, and Bilingual Review Press showed me this DVD that they did with you there, a DVD of you performing as well. Talk a little bit about your performance background and, you know, how music and all of that sort of factors into your poetry.
Sure. Well, again, there's a kind of cheat sheet element to what I'm doing now, because I used to work so much with bands, right, coming up, even though I have no musical beyond busting some salsa when I need to, right? So we worked with bands, and now, of course, we're all old and people have families and big-time jobs, so times are tough, right, for touring musicians, so we can't really do a lot of stuff with bands. So in a very pragmatic way, right, the smartphone becomes a stand-in for the band, right? And so, I mean, that's part of it. But then sometimes I complicate that, right? So I'll use a smartphone to play a demo that I recorded with the band, right, and then read over it, right? So you get a sense that the band isn't there. So I'm fascinated by that idea that technology promises a kind of connectivity, but it's often low-tech, lo-fi, right, incomplete, so kind of the sense you get when Skyping with somebody, right? It's sure better than not having, right, than not seeing them at all, right? But it has this really messy relationship to physical presence. Thinking of just the way, you know, people have thought about performance historically, right? People think about performance as the kind of irreducible materiality of the body, right? So, I'm thinking of a book like Diana Taylor's Archive and the Repertoire, right? So, you know, bodies are political, right, because they resist the power of the archive, right? They're immediate in that sense, right? But somehow now we're kind of all mediated. So I think more and more my performance work has become a kind of reflection on mediation, right? Like, I'm here in front of you, but I'm always also, right, with my smartphone, and you're also probably always checking your smartphone, right, while hearing me read. So it becomes this weird ambient relationship, thinking of Edwin Torres's book, Papyrology of an Ambient Language, right? So I'm interested in that idea of an ambient language, of a poetry that's coming from a kind of very personal and emotional place, but ultimately can be misheard, but still appreciated as a kind of ambient part, right, of living in a particular place or a particular city. So some of that, I think, involves, as I mentioned, the whole poetics of walking, right? So increasingly, and that's changed, you know, these poems in the book are a little earlier, but especially after things like Ferguson and Ayotzinapa, right? I've been thinking about just the politics of walking, right? And the politics of urban space, right? So a big part of that is walking through the Bronx, walking through San Juan. As you may know, Puerto Rico is in the midst of a debt crisis, right? Real or manufactured, right? So, and there's all kinds of connections between the hedge funds who are running things in places like the Bronx and in San Juan, right? So increasingly for me, walking is a way of claiming the kind of shared languages and shared histories of struggle, right, in both of those neighborhoods. And in a weird way, it's become, I've been writing about accidental archives. These video poems have become kind of accidental archives of a neighborhood, right? As once you do it for years, you realize, wow, that used to be a community bar or whatever, right? And now it's a bistro, right? As things gentrify, right, the city changes, and these walking poems become kind of testaments, right, to a kind of changing city. So there's that part of my performance work that's become increasingly about just the act of walking, about the durational, about, in a way, bringing, I think, performance closer to our everyday practices, right? You know, walking, being in a city, and that's maybe a sense of my frustration with the whole, you know, more institutional kind of performance, especially right. now that I'm a professor, right? So, mm-hmm. so how much can you do, especially, as you may know, in the rarefied realms of poetry, right? But pretty right. much you're reading to and for a whole bunch of other poets.
That also kind of responds in a way to the traditional flâneur poem, you know, the,
yes,
the French
absolutely.
Poem of just walking and everything's okay and right. everything's peaceful and mystical. It adds a complexity and attention to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm definitely writing about kind of digital flâneurs, right? I'm a big fan of Benjamin, right? He has his essay on Baudelaire, right? So the flâneur for him is has that fantasy, right, of falling into the city, but he's always in a he, because it's usually he, mm-hmm. is always in a tense relationship to the city, because, you know, that's the kind of the neurotic condition, right, of the modern self, and specifically the self, right, under capitalism, right? So that, in a weird right. way, that Benjaminian sense that we've lost our aura, right? We can't transcend. So what do? Is we walk the city, right, trying to seek a connection, right, is really something that I'm exploring, right, in some of right. the performance work now. But I think also collaboration is just super important, right? So that's one thing that you don't think about when you think of poets, right? You think maybe, you know, people reading from their book, right? But right. actually working with painters or right, working right. with musicians and thinking about poetry as, you know, a sound installation, right? Or
that's
a durational
right, yeah.
performance, you know, that's become increasingly important to me too.
Nice.
And I think also that's a kind of comment on my sense of the just the kind of the structural limitations, right, of
right.
what, of kind of the institutional brand of poetry. And I say that with someone with a PhD, but no
sure.
no MFA, right? So I feel that's, in a weird way, that's given me the freedom, right, to,
right, no,
to
yeah.
not worry about a certain way of making poetry and just fail spectacularly and hopefully figure stuff on the go, right?
Well, I wouldn't call the book a failure, a spectacular failure, but no, it's been fantastic. We're speaking with the poet and performance artist and NYU professor Urayoan Noel about his latest book, Buzzing Hemisphere, out by the University of Arizona Press. And Urayoan, if you will do us the honors of reading a poem from the book for our poem of the week.
Sure. Well, I'll give you a choice. I can do the anagrams or I can do a sonnet, performative sonnet.
Oh, do the sonnets. I like those.
Sonnets are good. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So again, a lot of the book is about self-translation, so I'll do the Spanish first and then the English. Solneto. Soneto silábico en escalinata. Sol, crisol, o frijol, grito bemol, perdido en el mall, de un downtown sin farol, en la ciudad de aerosol, y arterias de colesterol, postales de otra Sebastopol, interceptadas por la metropol, en rascacielos de sangre, tornasol, Apollinaire degolló soles en alcohol, los contraterroristas soplan su caracol, hologramas digitales de un falso rock and roll. Sonnet, syllabic staircase sonnet. Sun, you stun with your gun aimed at no one. Where car tires spun, now street heat comes undone, like some 70s rerun, burned under the skin just for fun. And the corpse, with its hair in a bun, tells the CEOs who call 911, no one is an island, but we are all done. While the mall music plays, we've only just begun, as remixed by the ghosts of La Lupe and Big Pun, and counter-terrorist texts, son, the enemy has won.
Wonderful.
That
was Urayoan Noel reading from his new book, Buzzing Hemisphere. Go out and pick that up. Urayoan, thank you so much for being on our show here on Words on a Wire. Good luck with everything you've got going on.
Thank you.
Thank you, familia. Thank you for the opportunity.